It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth. Navigating and avoiding getting lost is a bottom line requirement for spending time in the wilderness. It's also a sport and a source of competition. Today we'll learn about orienteering and along the way get tips about how to know where you are when you're traveling in the backcountry, solving that puzzle of navigation and also being safe. And also, I think a huge part of the fun of being outdoors is map reading and route finding and getting from where you wanted to start be to where you ended up, figuring out how far you can go, what your limits are. It's all related. And we've got a couple of perfect guests for this topic today. Roman Dial, who has been with us before and is famous for his outdoor exploits as a professor at Alaska Pacific University and a father of wilderness racing and of pack rafting. He's been with us a couple of times. Thanks for being with us, Roman.
Oh, it's really a pleasure, Charles.
And Jen Joliffe is with the Orienteering Club, former president of the Orienteering Club, and really, really involved. And I was surprised to find out just how active the Orienteering Club is in Anchorage and all the different stuff you're doing. And yet I'm betting that a lot of listeners may not know precisely what orienteering is. It's not the same as geocaching.
So Charles, thanks for having me. So orienteering is a worldwide sport that has specific regulations and very specific kinds of maps that are made for the sport. The symbology for the maps is the same. So if you travel worldwide, you can, without even speaking the language in the country that you're going to, get the orienteering map and participate in one of the competitions flawlessly with knowing what the symbology means. When you come to an orienteering meet, say in Anchorage, we have several different levels of competition at each one of our meets, and we do have weekly meets all summer long.
Wow.
It's totally open for people to come of all ages and participate. You will sign up for the course level that you feel like is appropriate for you, and then you'll get a map when your time starts. We have interval starts so that instead of everybody rushing out in a big mass where they all follow each other, every 2 minutes there'll be a start, and the participant who signed up for that time will leave. And you have, once your time starts, you have a map that shows different locations that you're supposed to go and navigate to. And instead of using a GPS or another electrical device, you're expected to use just your map reading skills and perhaps a compass if you're doing one of the more difficult courses. And all you have to do is read the map, the symbols on the map, look out into the real world and see the features that those symbols represent, and trace your way between the different spots. And when you get to one of the locations that's circled on your map, you'll find a small orange and white flag that has a hole punch on it, and you punch a card to prove that you got there. It's a special little punch that has a different number of little pinpoints for each spot. And after you've finished your course, you'll go back to the start and or the finish, and you'll have your time.
And it's a competition. Whoever does it first and punches all the punches is a winner.
Yes, in theory, it is a competition. Now, our club, we put on weekly meets, and we have five different levels of courses that we do. The people who do the upper level courses that are both longer and more technically difficult, they often want to run, and they look at it as being quite a competitive sport. And the results from the meets are listed in the paper and so forth. However, I'd like to say that we also have lots of families that come out, lots of, you know, best friends that want to kind of take a walk and have a little bit of a chat, but also be doing something at the same time. So they have to concentrate on kind of a teamwork task. So it's a little bit of team building for them.
Now, you said you don't always use a compass. So sometimes it's just a simple enough area that you can just sort of do it by sense of direction?
Not exactly sense of direction, mm-hmm. but by reading your map closely, following the features.
So
and I see
trails.
Roman nodding because he knows as well as anybody that you do have to keep in contact with your map. Your compass may be a good tool to help you get relocated if mm-hmm. you get lost from your map, but the main key is to follow along
right.
with the features.
So these maps are quite detailed, and so you can follow the contours and follow the landmarks and just figure it out that way.
Exactly. You can follow the trails, all of the roads that could possibly be on the map, plus each boulder that's bigger than 1 meter is on the map.
Oh, wow.
There
so
are,
you make these maps for each meet?
We we have professional orienteering mappers who come in and do it by regulation.
Wow.
They make the base maps, the maps, and then whoever is setting up the volunteer that's setting up the meet for the night cuts out a portion of that map on the computer and lays out the course design on it. But it is, they're highly detailed maps.
Who knew?
Yes. They're amazingly detailed. I mean, they have different kinds of vegetation, and I've never done an orienteering meet. I've always been drawn to it, but I don't like to run. But I think they have beautiful maps, and the
cool
detail and care they put into them is just amazing.
So what are some of the areas where you do it?
We have a lot of maps around Anchorage. The entire Far North Bicentennial Park is mapped, which we use as several different locales. Sometimes we do our starts from off of Campbell Airstrip Road, mm-hmm, and sometimes we'll start at Service High or at Hilltop or at Hillside just for that map, or from the Abbott Ballfields. Also, Kincaid is mapped. Bartlett High is mapped. The Russian Jack Park is mapped. We have other maps. We have several maps that are on the base. We have one on Elmendorf. We have one on Fort Rich. We have Crevasse Moraine up in Palmer. And the Tank Trails area, if you guys are familiar with that, of course, which is just east of Muldoon Road. We've got quite a lot of maps all around town.
I have so many more questions about that, but I want to bring Roman Dial into the conversation. And Roman, that's you got started with this wilderness racing concept, which is kind of like orienteering on steroids. It's like a long distances, not running, but it's a survival challenge as much as a race.
Right. Yeah. It is. It's much longer, and the maps we've used, at least in the Alaskan races, are old. You know, like made in the 50s, and so a lot
just
of time
USGS, ordinary USGS maps.
Yep, USGS mm-hmm maps. And and usually, like for me, I like the 1 to 250,000 scale. I think you guys use, like, what is the scale you use, Jen?
Our scale for a lot of our maps, it's 1 to 10,000. However, we have a brand new map of Earthquake Park, and if you've been there, you know how incredibly intricate the terrain is. It's where the land is kind of sloughed off into the ocean, and it's 1 to 4,000.
Yeah, so that's
amazing.
Like 1 to 250,000. 1 inch is about 4 miles, and the other USGS map is the 1 to 62,360.
Mm-hmm.
63,360, I forget what it is, but the 1 inch to 1 mile map. And I don't use those very often because, I walk off of them too quickly. Whereas a 1 to 250,000 scale map, you know, you can get a few days in on it. And it feels good because you look at the map and you say, oh, I'm about here, and you put your finger on it, and that area could be like 2 or 3 square miles. So you feel like you know where you are, even though you're not nearly as precisely located as you would be with 1 to 4,000.
So this is a totally different type of navigation, because as opposed to following the map and staying in touch with the map, you're just sort of saying, we're going to go that direction, and then whatever we run into, we're going to figure out a way to get around it.
Yes and no. I mean, I'm a compulsive map reader. But
those 250 scale maps, I mean, there's so little detail on them.
Yeah, but you can know, you learn how to read them, you know, because they were drawn by people, and you kind of learn, for example, where a canyon is, kind of, they almost always will draw the line on the rim of the canyon, mm-hmm, for example. And I pay close attention. I write on my maps all the time. I don't really keep a journal except on my map. And so I put the times where I have been. Every time we'll stop, you know, I'll pull out the map and I'll write down, yeah, here's the time, or where we saw animals. And I used to be a lot more detailed. I would rate the brush, because other people would ask me later, hey, Roman, I heard you did such and such. What was it like? And I wouldn't remember, so I'd get the map out and I could tell them.
In other words, how nasty and horrible was it to climb through the brush?
Yeah, like I had a grading system, you know, from 1 to 6.
Like, and, 6 is like you just kill yourself.
I do have to add that on the orienteering maps, and Roman made reference to this earlier, that we have the vegetation mapped, mm-hmm, not just where there's vegetation, where there's not, but the difficulty of running through the vegetation. So it's not like black spruce here and Devil's Club there. It's the white area means that it's really easy to run through. Light green means that you're slowing down. You're probably walking through it. And by the time it gets to the darkest green, it's called officially fight.
Yeah, it's fighting your way through those alders. Yeah.
New Zealanders and Australians use that fight brush word.
Exactly.
I do keep track of the map. And I just like the 1 to 250,000 because in Alaska, when you're traveling, in the wilderness, there aren't really any trails, which is a real, I mean, that's the attraction.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, I love finding trails, but I get really bored on them after a while. I mean, I love finding an ATV trail after I've been through the fight brush, but then if I'm on an ATV trail for too long, I'm bored, and I never really know where it's going to go, whereas animal trails are much more appealing to me, and I've spent about 30 years trying to figure out how to find and especially hold animal trails.
Yeah.
And, you know, I followed animal trails, you know, in Australia and Africa and Borneo. And it's always interesting to follow like a kangaroo trail, you know, where they hop and then they drag their tail right down the dirt in the middle. And it looks like a single track trail sort of,
yeah.
You know,
but the thing that for me is that, once you're out beyond any human landmarks, everything kind of looks the same. You know, I find that, you know, one mountain looks a lot like another, one river looks a lot like another, and it's so easy to get confused. Maybe you're looking at me like I'm a complete idiot, but I think it's true. I mean, because natural places are made by processes, and so they tend to repeat. And, you know, having some kind of technology to figure out the way and not sort of trust myself in terms of, like, looking around and knowing, well, this is the way I went, and, you know, obviously when you're going up a mountain, you're always turning around and looking how it looked so you remember it on the way down, but I still find it difficult. I mean, do you find that, Roman, or are you just have such a good memory or such a good sense of the landscape that you can read it?
I've made blunders for sure. You know, especially exactly like you said, sometimes there'll be a process and you'll get two sort of formations in exactly the same place. And
yeah.
When I was a competitive navigator in adventure racing in the 90s, I made some bad blunders where I thought we were here, but I was on the wrong plateau or in the wrong valley. And usually the real key is to always be checking the map and looking around. That's why I like the 1 to 250,000, because I can see, you know, the distant peaks. Mm-hmm. One time that we did a wilderness classic from Nabezda to McCarthy, and a competitor, to save weight, he took the 250,000 scale map, and then he just cut like a 1-inch line all the way through the map because he thought that was going to be his route. And so,
off the map.
he never knew where he was because he could never see any landmarks. And so having the 250,000 scale map is nice because you can see all the far distant landmarks and peaks and valleys, because Alaska is nice and open. The trees are short. You know, bushwhacking through thick forest is a completely different thing. I avoid it. Usually, if you're in thick forest, then you've got to pull out the compass and
really hard to figure out where you are and what direction anything is.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. You just kind of blind reckoning.
I love that story about the cutting out the line along the map. But orienteering, the sport, is such a small scale event compared to what you're talking about, that actually one of the things that orienteers do for official trainings is to make maps that are exactly what you just said. So they'll, on the computer, erase everything except for a line that's maybe a swath, kind of 100 feet wide around the area that they want the orienteers to try to navigate through, and send them out to try to follow the line. And there'll be controls along that line somewhere. They don't even know where they are. And they'll try to follow that line of map,
wow,
you know, across contours or along contours. And
well, if you fall off the map, then you're kind of in trouble, huh?
Yeah. Indeed. But, you know, it's a lot smaller bounty if you're a...
You're not that lost.
You're not that lost.
Yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about orienteering and wilderness navigation. Jen Joliffe is with me from the Orienteering Club, and Roman Dial, we'll just call him an outdoorsman. we could list a lot of credits, but he's well known in town. Jen, it sounds like orienteering involves a lot of bushwhacking, and we got into talking about bushwhacking a little bit. It's not everybody's idea of fun. When you're doing your orienteering, are you trying to figure out sort of the easiest way to get through the woods so you don't have to bash around in the bad stuff?
That's a great question, Charles. And the answer is that is what orienteering is all about. It's about weighing your route choices.
Mm-hmm.
So when I look at number one, say, where I'm located right now, because I just punched the first control I was supposed to get to, and I'm looking ahead towards number two, if someone has set the course well, then there will be numerous possibilities. And one of those possibilities may be to run 7K around a really easy trail system. And another possibility to me might be going 1K that involves crossing a swamp in the middle where you don't know exactly how deep the swamp is, but it will be tough going. And another route choice might be to go around the swamp cross country, still not on trails, but to have to do a serious amount of climb in between, you know, several hundred meters of climb. And that would be a third choice. And I have to look at my own abilities. I personally don't really like getting my feet wet. I'm a pretty good hill climber, and I'm not the fastest trail runner out there. So probably choice number three of going over the hills slightly further than the swamp, but keeping my feet dry might be the way that I would be fastest.
Do some people just say, you know, whatever, I can take a shower, I'm just going to smash through the swamp, I'm going to climb through the alders, straight line is the fastest. And I'm curious whether that's ever a good strategy.
It is, depending on the individual. If you're someone who can look at a large field of Devil's Club and say, I don't really care, I'm going to go for it, and you just launch off through it,
how
and you don't
Carhartt
care that you're tight.
You wearing? Yeah.
Well, you know, and most people are wearing pretty lightweight clothing because they're running. So, you know, I don't care if my tights get thrashed and I'm muddy up above my knees, and they'll go for it. And, you know, sometimes I do that too if it looks like a short enough distance that I know that it's worthwhile. It partly has to do with how I feel for the day. And yeah, there are definitely people who make that choice. And of course, there are alders, which are everybody's bane in Alaska. And it's a really sad day when the alders look like the good choice.
Right. So who usually wins? Is it the person who is the most fit or the person who is the smartest in reading the map and choosing a route?
It has to be a balance.
There's fitness, there's reading the map and choosing the route. Three aspects to it.
Exactly, yeah. You're right about that. I remember when I was very first starting orienteering maybe 20 years ago, and my mother-in-law was doing orienteering then, and she would always walk the course, and I would always run really fast in the wrong direction. And she beat me every time, and I knew that I was faster than her, but still she would beat me every time, and I was so frustrated. Another one of our good competitors, Toby Schwor, is a runner that everybody knows about. Toby, a fabulous runner, and when he first started doing orienteering, he would, again, run very fast in the wrong direction until we think that Toby's turning point was when he broke his back. And he still, within a month or so, was out orienteering again with his clamshell brace on. But he was forced to walk at that point. And he, that summer, made leaps and bounds of progress because he really learned to read the map well. And then he became a much better map reader and route choice maker. And now he can both run fast and in the right direction.
Sounds like a really challenging sport if it takes that much learning and experience to get good at it.
Well, it is a challenging sport if you want to be one of those kind of top competitors. Mm-hmm. However, I would say that probably 70% of the people who come to our meets are more of the recreational variety. They want to get out and get a little bit of a workout, and they enjoy reading maps. But many people come, as I said before, with friends, and many people come with their families. I myself have a son who just turned 7, and I've had a completely different orienteering experience for the last 7 years, getting to help him be interested in orienteering and learn it. And now we do the easiest courses together. And it's really gratifying this year. He's finally able to process in his head enough to make the decisions and lead the way. And it's really fun.
There's a real issue of just cognitive, sort of how your brain is set up, right? I mean, some people have a sense of direction and can read a map well, and some don't. Have you found that?
Oh, yeah. There are a lot of people who come year after year after year, and their skills improve a little bit, but they are never going to be as adept at translating the symbols on the map into features in the real world.
Yeah.
I had a friend. He was really good at route finding. You know, like, he could find and hold game trails remarkably well, but he never knew where we were on the map. And, you know, he never wanted to carry the map either, you know, because he just liked looking at the landscape and kind of like an animal. I mean, an animal doesn't read a map, but an animal knows really well what the fastest, quickest, easiest way would be to go. So that is, you know, reading maps is sort of a separate issue from sort of picking routes and evaluating the fastest way to go, I think.
Right. Yeah. And I think that especially in the larger scale, that reading the map only gets you so far. And you may be able to identify, here's the map and here I am, and know where you are within that space. But in getting from where I am here to the mountain that I see 2 miles away, it is more that understanding of how vegetation and topography works in Alaska. And also
like where animals like to travel. And that's a huge piece of it, you know, because we're blessed. Because I love traveling off trail, and I've traveled around the world looking for places that are as good as Alaska. And the reason we're blessed is we've got, you know, moose and caribou and bears and wolves, you know, like certain trails get a lot of, I call them BMW trails. You know, they're usually really fast. Everybody uses them. And when I say everybody, I think of all the animals that are out mm-hmm. there. So BMWs are bear, moose, and wolf. And then caribou trails, you know, I like, they're up in the tundra. They don't really like to get their feet wet. Moose, I usually don't like just pure moose trails. They go through thick brush and they don't mind getting their feet wet, and they have real corrugated. Bear trails are awesome, but they're really scary. And sometimes, you know, brown bears are tunnels through the brush, and you're crawling, and it smells like bears, and it smells like salmon, and you're wondering if you're going to bump into one. But they're usually, in the alpine country, they're really nice. Sheep trails are fun. You don't really need them, but they're fun when they're there. And goat trails are necessary in South Central.
Because otherwise you might get to a spot where you can't navigate.
Yeah, the animals always know where to go, you know. Mm-hmm. I did a trip with this colleague of mine at APU, Jason Geck. He and I walked like 600 miles from Kivalina to the Hall Road, and we followed caribou trails. And one time, you know, we were crossing some peak, a pass in the Brooks Range, and it was snowing and rainy and foggy. And we had been following these caribou trails, and that's the other thing I like about sort of big scale orienteering, is how much intuition is involved, because it's fun to just rely on your intuition. And it's difficult if you're racing with somebody, you have to explain your intuition, but I really like that part. But my intuition took me in the wrong direction. And Jason says, Roman, you know, we're not on those animal trails anymore. Do you really think this is the right way? Oh, yes, Jason, this is the right way. Come on, keep up, you know? And then the weather broke, and we found ourselves on the edge of a precipice. And he's like, I think we should go back down and see where everybody else is going. Uh-huh. So we went back down and picked up the caribou trails. And so we're really blessed to have animal trails here, because they almost always go, you know, kind of where you should go. Whereas like in South America, like in Patagonia, you know, I've been to Patagonia a few times, and I don't really like it because there's really no wild animals there, and the brush is really bad, you know, and there's no animals. Same with like Tasmania. Tasmania's got pretty much the worst brush in the world, and there's no big animals to put trails in. And New Zealand, you know, they have sheep, but that's no fun to follow, you know, domestic sheep trails. So I think Alaska is like the best place in the world for off-trail travel, wilderness travel.
Yeah, yeah, cool. So when you were deciding, you know, today I want to start, I'm at this river, there's this mountain in the way, I want to end up over at that river, and I got to figure out the best route by looking at this map. Do you sit down and study the map and sort of trace, okay, I'm going to go like this, I'm going to make sure to avoid that cliff, I'm going to follow this contour, and do your route finding that way, or are you a little bit more ad hoc as you're going?
Well, it's a mixture, you know, like it kind of depends on where you are. Different geological, I'm not a geologist, but sort of different geological formations, you can kind of predict will have certain attributes. And so in what I usually do is, I plan the route kind of ahead of time, and usually I follow river valleys and go over passes and then float down rivers on the other side and things like that. But
do you like to just walk in the creek? I mean, usually
no,
that's
I hate. I always, really? If you got to walk in the creek, I think if I walk in the creek, I've made a mistake. Like that, I only do that as desperation. Like animals hate to walk in the water too. Like, because your feet get soft and sore. I'm not as fast as I used to be, but I try to kind of maintain a certain amount of style. Even though there's nobody there to like evaluate my style, it's like for me, like walking in a creek means I've made a big mistake. Like
really?
If that's the last chance, that means I haven't really, there's no animal trails along the side, you know? And that means maybe you shouldn't even be in that valley. Like maybe there's not a good way out if there's no animal trails there. But usually what I'll do is I kind of map it out, like with the 1 to 250,000 scale, I kind of think, well, you know, maybe I can get 10 or 15 miles today and we're going to walk up this valley. And then I just look at the landscape and I could not have predicted exactly where we would walk, you know, because the river changes since the map was made. It might have swung over to this side or that side, and there might be a better gravel bar on the other side, and there might be a good animal trail over here. And that's one of the things about animal trails is they're not always there. You know, they're often there. So when you do get one and you're like, yeah, I got it. This is right where I thought it would be. And let's follow this. It feels really good. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they're not there. So it's really, I can't say with precision where I'll be, but I do plan out like within, like up a river corridor. But I couldn't tell you which side of the river right. we'd be on.
But you're going to sort of look at the map and sort of think, well, this pass looks like it's doable. That one doesn't.
Sure. Yeah. You can look at the, yeah. I mean, look at the contours. And mm-hmm. again, I like those 1 to 250,000 scale maps. I mean, when I'm in the mountains and I'm going over passes I've never been before, I'll often bring along the 1 to 63,360 to kind of just really be sure, you mm-hmm. know, because I might have to take another route. But yeah, I mean, I look at the contours and I look at the color of the vegetation, even though the colors on the maps, you know, so much new brush has grown and the trees right. have changed since the maps were made.
Maps were made a really long time ago. Mm-hmm. And because of climate change, there's been a huge increase in brush.
Yeah, it's remarkable. Yeah. I mean, just in like my life mm-hmm. wandering around the woods, I've seen the brush change. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, I mean, it's kind of ad hoc, but I also look at the map before I look at the map. I'm always looking at the map. There's like, I could probably rattle off 20 trips that I've wanted to do for the last 15 years, and I just can't always get somebody who wants to do them this year or that year.
Wow, this is a really fun topic. We're going to have to take a break, and we'll come back to talk more about orienteering and wilderness navigation with Roman Dial, wilderness racer, and Jen Joliffe with the Orienteering Club. A lot more about competition orienteering, and we're going to get into how you as a non-expert can avoid getting lost and find your way out if you do get lost, because that's really important thing to know. And we'll talk a little bit about technology too, and what role technology plays in wilderness navigation in Alaska today, and to what level we can trust that, and what kind of backups you need to have. So all that's coming up in the second half of the show. But first, it's time for the Outdoor Explorer Family Calendar. Our go-to family outdoors person is Aaron Kirkland, author of Alaska on the Go and publisher of the AKA on the Go website. I'm Charles Wolforth. Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
Welcome to the Outdoor Explorer Family Calendar. I'm Aaron Kirkland, publisher of akontheGo.com, here with a kid-friendly list of summer-themed outdoor activities.
I love to play outside. It's awesome.
Summer does mean farmers markets, and all across the state, families pick and choose their favorite Alaska-grown foods. No matter where you are, there's a market nearby. The State Division of Natural Resources has an excellent list of farmers markets on their website, dnr.alaska.gov, or just Google Alaska Farmers Markets DNR list. That's what I did. National Trails Day is Saturday, June 7th, and many public land agencies will be hosting work parties or group activities to promote Alaska trails and outdoor recreation. Sitka Trail Works will be conducting a work party to promote the Herring Cove Trail. Sign up at walksitka.wordpress.com. In Anchorage, the Campbell Creek Science Center invites the whole family to participate in activities around this 700-acre facility. Find more information at friendsofcampbellcreek.org. And one of my favorite Alaska museums is hosting a fun run. But not just any fun run. This one has a definite appeal to the prehistoric animal in all of us. Joining me in the studio to talk about the Alaska Museum of Science and Nature's Fossil 5K and T-Rex 10K is Jeff Attridge, the museum's development director. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, pretty darn good. But so tell me about a dinosaur-themed run. What's the mission behind this?
You know, we love dinosaurs up in Mountain View. We are the Dinosaur Museum in Mountain View. And part of what we like to do is hands-on science. It's one of our big missions. And, you know, running, believe it or not, is, anthropologically speaking, is, you know, huge, and a huge part of what makes humans human. And scientifically speaking, you know, humans are fantastic runners. We run competitively. We run to hunt. It's part of what helped, you know, put humans at the top of the food chain. So, you know, we kind of like to think of running as just another extension of hands-on science. And that's kind of what we're trying to do here with this 10K.
So that is cool. So when and where is this going to be? Because I know it used to be just at Cutty Midtown Park, but you've moved it out into the wilderness a little bit.
Oh, yeah. We decided to ramp things up. So this year it's going to be out at Kincaid. It's an absolutely gnarly course. So
but now both runs, right? So we have a 5K and a 10K.
Correct.
Okay.
Both runs. The 5K is geared more towards kids, you know, so the 10K is going to be a super gnarly, you know, trail running experience. It's going to be, you know, the run of the summer. And the 5K is just, it's going to be a super fun run. You're going to be out, you know, out and about in the forest. So, you know, just come on down and it's going to be a great time. We're going to be meeting at the Timing Shack in Kincaid. By the big oval.
Okay.
And that's going to be on Monday, June 9th at 6:30 p.m.
Oh, so an evening run after work.
Yes.
Right.
Oh, yes.
On. So how can we sign up for this?
You can sign up a couple different ways. You can sign up online at our website. That's www.alaskamuseum.org, Alaska all spelled out. And you can pay via PayPal on the website, and we'll just put you right on the sign-up form that way. Or you can do it the old-fashioned way. Come on down to the museum and just tell, you know, Judy at the front desk that you want to sign up, and, you know, you'll be good to go.
So where is this museum, by the way? Because it's one of my faves.
We are right down in the heart of Mountain View at 201 North Bregaw. We're right at the corner of Mountain View Drive and Bregaw, conveniently located off of Fifth Avenue.
You know, you really can't miss it because there's an enormous T-Rex on the front
absolutely.
Of the building, right?
Exactly. Yeah, you know, it's worth the trip just to check out the murals on the building.
Right on. Well, Jeff, thanks. So we'll see you at Kincaid Park on Monday, June 9th at 6:30 p.m.?
6:30, yes.
6:30. All right, cool. Look for links to the Alaska Museum of Science and Nature and all events mentioned in the family calendar at alaskapublic.org. And be sure to listen in next month for more kid-friendly fun. In the meantime, get outdoors and enjoy your Alaska. I'm Erin Kirkland with akonthego.com for Outdoor Explorer.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking today about orienteering and wilderness navigation with the related topic of bushwhacking and crashing your way through alders and devil's clubs and all that fun stuff. We haven't really gotten into why you'd want to do that, but I'm sure we will in the second half. And we're also going to talk about how just regular folks can avoid getting lost, what kind of equipment and technology are good to bring, and how to best work on finding yourself once you do get lost, and also more about orienteering, the sport of orienteering. Maybe you'd like to give it a try. Sounds like a fun family thing. So that's all coming up, and I've got two guests to talk about it. Roman Dial is a biology professor at Alaska Pacific University and has done all kinds of outdoor stuff all over Alaska, including wilderness racing. And Jen Jolliffe is with the Arctic Orienteering Club. And you can find a link to the club's website to find out all the information you want about their events and when they're taking place on our website at alaskapublic.org. Just click on today's show. So, Jen, it sounds like it's pretty easy to start out in orienteering. It's not, I mean, you just essentially show up?
It's really easy. The first thing probably you should do is to check out our website mm-hmm. that you referred to. That'll let you know when the next meet's going to be. And just next week's meet, we always meet on Wednesday evenings all summer long. As I told you before, we have interval starts, which means not everybody's starting in one big mass start. And so there'll always be a range of times that's listed, and it's usually 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock. So
if you show up. Do you need to pre-register or just show up?
You don't have to pre-register yet. We keep talking about changing that, but at the moment you can just show up anytime between 5 o'clock and about 6:30 so that you have plenty of time to get signed in and then get your start time. Our next week's meet is going to be at Stork Park, which is if you drive south along the Seward Highway and you take the last exit, Rabbit Creek Road, and you go up towards Bear Valley, it's just there as you're turning in on Clark's Road, which is on the right. And there's a big park up there, gorgeous, in the mountains, large green field to start in with a little chalet, and then the forest is all around, and we have some nice mountains and a nice swamp that you can try to avoid.
And how far do you typically go on one of these evening meets?
Okay, so the shortest course is almost always just a kilometer to a kilometer and a half. It is usually either stroller accessible or almost such, so that you could carry a baby and your baby Bjorn and go out hiking. It's great for new families, and you know, your three-year-old can walk along with you.
Just an adventure for after dinner on Wednesday night, or
Yep, and your kid can punch all the control punches, and they think that that's pretty exciting, and they'll be able to spot the flags off in the distance as you walk around. It's very simple, usually on trails. The next more difficult course, usually 2.5 kilometers or so. At last night's was actually about 3.5 kilometers. I went on that with my son, who's 7, and his friend, who's also 7. You're navigating mostly on trails. There'll be a little bit of off-trail just to kind of get people started thinking about what we call handrail features, which would be walking along a stream or along the base of a really obvious cliff or mountain, something that is or around the edge of a swamp. So going around edges of things that are not trails, that are natural features. The next step up is our third course is usually a little bit longer than that, maybe 4 kilometers long, but it's going to be a lot more off trails. So you'll be navigating. You might have a choice for taking a long trail route versus a shorter cross-country route, but learning more to use your topographic line knowledge, so following the contours on the map and following the physical features more, really navigating. And then our two most advanced courses are the same difficulty technically, finding smaller features, more difficult map reading skills, and definitely needing to use a compass in some areas because you'll need to take an actual bearing, follow on a compass bearing to get to your site, as opposed to being able to simply navigate by the features. It's possible. And those are two different lengths, so that we have kind of a short, difficult course and a longer, difficult course. And the longest one is usually about 7 kilometers. That's
sounds like quite a production.
Straight line distance. It is. So the kilometers are straight lines,
so
like if you drew a line
long,
straight across the map, and then it might be longer, depending on your route choice. But it is a lot of work. I was thinking about that earlier. I was thinking in my head, how many volunteer hours does Arctic Orienteering put into making these courses every year? And it's definitely in the thousands of volunteer hours.
How many people come out on a typical evening?
Most of our meets get about 100 participants. So it's not overcrowded, but it's a bunch of people coming out wandering around
in the
woods.
Fee?
There is a fee. It's $8 to come out and do one of the courses. Kids are free. So if you have an adult and a kid together, the kids are free. And that cost is going largely towards the printing of our maps and the making of the paying the mappers to come in and make the maps.
Which is all by itself a really cool idea.
We're a nonprofit.
That there are these map makers out there. Who gets that job? That sounds really fun.
Well, and so, if only there were more in America, but it seems like we often have to hire folks from Europe just because they're the ones that have the expertise.
Wow. Neat. So what kind of compass would you use? I mean, does it matter the quality of the compass, and is there any other equipment that you commonly need?
Really, a compass is all you need, and whatever shoes you feel comfortable destroying. But So for orienteering, we have a special kind of compass that we call a thumb compass. It's not a mandatory piece of equipment. Lots of the competitive runners use it, but it's actually way more simple than the compass that you might take out in the wilderness with you. And you can essentially just slip it on your thumb. It has an elastic band on it, and all it does is point north. All it does is have the needle that points to the north. It has one straight edge that you line up with along the direction of where you want your route to go, and then you pinch it all together and turn your entire body until the north is pointing to the north direction on your map, and then run towards where you want to go.
Where do you find one of those?
I'm not sure if you can get a thumb compass at REI. That's the only place I can think of in town that you might be able to, but you could order one. However, almost everybody, except for the most competitive of the orienteers, uses just a basic plate compass that I think maybe costs $20 at REI.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to try one of those little compasses. I just love the idea. Every time I hear an orienteer talk about orienteering, I'm like, I'm going to the next one. This sounds like so much fun. And they're usually really enthusiastic, Jen here. You know, she's all lit up about it. And just, I love the idea of a super simple compass. And I like the idea of that the challenging races are the ones that are all off trail and that you have to make decisions. But I think maybe I'm getting to the age where I could go do one. Charles, you and I should go do one together, you know?
Because, you should.
Because I still have a bit of a competitive streak, and I think maybe that's one reason I
have a feeling you would win.
No, I don't think I would win, and that's probably why I stayed away. But now I'm okay with not winning, and I could just show up and have fun, and I'd see a bunch of people that I know. It sounds like a fun party,
fun.
I would love to do it. I love the idea of walking around the woods off trail, and I think it'd be fun to try to find these controls. I've never done one. I've heard of it my whole life. I'm 53, and I remember being 12 and 13.
We do it at Junior Nordic sometimes with the kids, where that sort of as a treat, put little candy caches around in the woods, and they have a map, and they have to find the candy.
Nice.
And they love doing that. Kids love working with maps, and it's one of the things that will actually get a kid away from technology. Because it's so cool. Correspondence between the world and this piece of paper.
And it's like an Easter egg hunt, except you actually have the facility to know where the Easter eggs are. That you can actually know that.
Easter egg hunt, for those of us who are a little bit more linear, we don't want to wonder, we want to know.
I do want to get back to Roman just a moment about the thumb compass, because I'm hoping that you'll never take one with you on one of your adventures, and I'll tell you why. All of the orienteering official maps are oriented to magnetic north. Mm-hmm. Is at the top of the map. And as you know, you would be in big trouble if you started trying to use that theory when you were using a USGS map.
Well, usually I just use a compass. I very, very, very rarely triangulate to see where I am, because that means I don't know where I am. And I want some precision. And as we were talking about earlier, I kind of keep track of where I am on the map all the time. I keep it stuffed in my shirt right here, and I pull it out and I look at it, and I get my pencil out at 12 o'clock. Here's where we are. Saw a bear. So I kind of always know where I am. But when I'm in bad brush, or like a whiteout on the Harding Ice Field, or, marching through a swamp that's flat and featureless, I do use a compass just to keep myself pointed in the right direction. Sometimes I look at the sun. I keep the sun at a certain angle, when I have to walk on a straight line, but the sun's moving, so you can't do that for very long, but I kind of use that as a handrail, if you will, just the angle of the sun. But I do use a compass, but I almost always just use it in the magnetic form anyway. And so I just like the idea.
Because you're not worried about high precision like you'd be with a bearing compass or something.
Right, yeah. One time I skied across the Harding Ice Field by myself in a whiteout, and I had one of these little Silva compasses that has a safety pin, and I pinned it on my jacket. And I just kind of looked down at it and I knew I wanted to go 10 degrees to the, west of south. Mm-hmm. And I just sort of pinned it on there. It had a big bubble, so it was a really crappy compass, a big air bubble in there. And then I also I've always wanted to touch one or feel or fondle one, but I've seen them. I think they're really well damped too, right?
I'll show you out in the car later.
Yeah. Cool.
So what other equipment do you take for navigation when you're on a wilderness trip?
A map and I do bring a compass. I almost never use it. Like I said, I do keep it around my neck.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever bring a GPS?
Yes, I do, but mostly, I let other people carry the GPS. The only reason I've really brought one is I've kind of been working on a guidebook for 30 years. It's not going to ever come out. But I went through a stage where I thought it was really important to record where different things are. Like, I even went to like recording where a good game trail might be, which is really kind of an anachronism to mm-hmm. use a GPS to record where a game trail is. So I do have them. I use them for work a lot, and a lot of my friends use them a lot, and I just let them. They're really good at
it. Do you think it takes some of the fun away?
Well, for me, it does. I mean, I got one of the first GPSs when they were first sort of mm-hmm. available. There was like $400 or $500 for this, you know, black and white piece of crap. And I tried it out. I was really excited about it. And then I realized I'm just looking at the screen, you know? I'm out here watching where I go on the screen, and I'm not out here to look at a screen. You know, if I want to look at a screen, I'll stay home and look at my computer, you know? And so I really don't like looking at the screen. And so I mean, I have them, but I almost never use them. I let somebody else bring them because they might like them. So no, I'm not. I'd rather look at the. I like staying in touch with nature and looking at it, and I just use it sort of as a recording device.
How about you, Jen? Do you use a GPS when you're out on a wilderness trip?
Not really. Like Roman, my partner and I, we got a GPS back 15 or 20 years ago, one of the earlier ones, and The only thing we've really used it for recently is tracking paraglider logs.
So that's another thing you do is paragliding.
Yes. Yeah, we both like to fly. But we don't use the GPS so much anymore. We actually do use it some for mapping, which is what my husband does. But if we have orienteering maps that need updates and we're not ready to hire a mapper to do a complete update, we'll walk the trail with the GPS to use it as a recording device, as Roman said, just to add in trails into a map we have.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about orienteering and wilderness navigation today, and two guests in the studio, Jen Joliffe, you were just hearing from, who is with the Arctic Orienteering Club. You can find out all about their club from their website, which is linked through our website at alaskapublic.org. Just click on today's show, Orienteering and Wilderness Navigation. And the other guest is Roman Dial, who is, as you can hear from his discourse, has been everywhere and done everything, and who probably should be the host of the show, but I happened to get it first, so I can still have him in as a guest. So let's get communication in here, because that's sort of an important aspect that goes along with navigation. You know, I'm sure when you started doing your wilderness trips, and probably you too, Jen, and certainly me, there was no question of being able to contact anyone. I mean, if you had to let people know generally where you're going to go, and if you didn't come back, they'd come looking for you. There wasn't a question of, like, if you hurt yourself, calling someone on the phone. Now the communication is almost, you know, sat phones and with, you know, GPSs and these devices which I haven't used, but that track your location on the web so people can figure out where you are. It's a completely different world. What kind of communication do you use, and what do you think is sort of, I mean, there are those like Dick Griffith, who will go on an Arctic expedition, doesn't take any kind of phone because he says, well, if I get in trouble, I might call. Most of us wouldn't take quite that attitude. We'd say, well, if I get in trouble, I would like to call. So there is some kind of minimum.
Right.
For most of us, I think.
Well, you know, today, if I'm out with a group, but let me just start with saying I kind of treat communication the way I treat bear preparation. Like when I go out on a trip, even for a day trip, what I take for bear protection depends on who I'm with and how they feel. And I'm the same way with communication. So I don't really like to take any communication, but if I'm going someplace for a long time and I want to talk to my wife, I'll take a sat phone. If I'm taking an APU course out, there's this DeLorme InReach gizmo you can text, satellite text. And so I do take, you know, kind of like the cutting edge of consumer technology if I can, if I'm in charge of a group, because I don't want to be a Craig Medved story, you know, in the Alaska Dispatch.
Right.
You know, where, why didn't Roman Dial just killed 7 students? Why didn't he have a satellite phone and an InReach? You know,
so that'd be the worst part of it, right?
Oh, it is. I've thought about that. Oh my God, this could turn into a Medved column, you know, and right. I'm like, I better be careful. So, so when I was directing the Wilderness Classic I've directed several different decades, but one, and I think in the 90s, two people didn't show up. And
the wife of one of them kept calling
me.
So
just so people know, the idea of the wilderness classic is you start at one location, you end up at the other, and where you are in between is up to you.
Yeah, it's sort of like a great big giant orienteering course, except there's only two control points, the start and the end.
And it could be hundreds of miles apart.
Hundreds of miles. Yeah, literally. Like, I think the longest one is like 300 miles. And so so two people hadn't shown up, and I kept thinking they're going to show up. And this was in the day when Dick Griffith would bring up, he'd be the sweep, and there were these sign-in sheets at cabins. And he would always bring up the rear and pick up the sign-in sheets. Well, somebody else thought they would be Dick Griffith, and they'd picked up the sign-in sheets, and they were the person who was missing. And so I was like pulling my hair out, and the wife was calling me, and there was nothing I could do. I was flying around in an airplane, and there was another person missing too. Actually, there were like four people missing. Two caught a boat ride into Talkeetna. I found the other one, the middle one, and she was on top of a dome. She'd started a fire, and we were flying around. We found her, and then this other guy, I don't even know what ever happened to him, actually. I mean, he did come out eventually, you know, I don't know what happened to him. And after that, I was like, everybody's got to have a satellite phone, everybody. And Dick Griffith, who's been around the race since the beginning, he's like, oh, no, I don't need no stinking satellite phone, you know. And so the very next year, it was mandatory, and Dick was traveling with a guy who fell down with a heavy pack and dislocated his shoulder, and they had to call on the satellite phone to get a helicopter in to pick up the guy with the dislocated shoulder. But Dick, of course, continued on, you know, and he still wouldn't take a satellite phone. But I think it's kind of irresponsible now. It's sort of like not wearing a seatbelt. You know, the technology
is there.
If it's
available, why not? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to use it if you're not in trouble.
Right. I don't think it shouldn't be a crutch. I think it should just be another sort of tools.
But it is hard to decide, isn't it? The Orienteering Club on a very small scale is dealing with the same issue of, we were trying to decide last week, shall we start printing the meet director's cell phone number on the map so that if somebody's out on the course and they get lost, then they can call in and they can, you know, just get a bearing to essentially walk out a straight line and find, you know, the nearest road system or whatever. And then we started thinking, we were thinking, oh, this is fantastic. This will be, what a great idea this is. And then we thought, but how many more people are going to decide to bail out because they have that easy way to bail out? And it is a hard decision that once you have an easy way to bail out, it's a lot easier to make that decision than to persevere and to try harder and to really do your most.
Did you decide?
We haven't decided yet.
Oh, okay. So it's still up in the air. Have you had any, I mean, I would think there would be mishaps. People can fall down and get hurt. And what kinds of bad things can happen?
I'm looking around and there's almost no wood in the studio.
Right.
But we have been really fortunate so far to have very few accidents in the orienteering club, and we did last year start doing kind of a military style drill, search and rescue drill operation, just getting protocol down for what we'll do if there ever is a big incident.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, I can count on one hand the times that I've been called back to look for somebody, and we're definitely frontline people that are called back to look if anybody is late getting back. And it's never even been a serious issue.
Right. Well, I mean, nobody thought anybody would get lost on the Mount Marathon race either. And then one year, somebody just disappeared, never found.
Right. And every meet, or every season at least, we do have wildlife incidents of people running into moose and bears and getting spooked off of a course. But fortunately, we've never had any actual incidents there either of anybody getting injured.
Let's talk for a minute about what to do if you do get lost. And if you are, for most of us, I think we're probably not going to be like Roman, like absolutely out in the middle of Alaska, 100 miles from anything. You know, you might be going up over the Chugach and drop down into the wrong valley and can't figure out where you are. You might be, you know, there's a bunch of ways you could get lost. And it seems to be one of the main ways people get in trouble in Alaska in the summertime. And there's always a few people who don't find their way back. I don't know. Thoughts. What do you do when you just first realize that you're lost? Who wants to take it? Jen?
Sure. Well, if I'm on an orienteering course in Anchorage area, the great thing is that from almost any of our maps, you can see the mountains. And
right.
So that's always the fail-safe. Oh, well, there's the east over there. And then it's easy to reorient yourself. Usually before I begin a meet, I'll think about where am I? In terms of whatever the nearest kind of bailout road system would be. Usually in the Orienteering Club, we also have a bailout direction that we recommend people go, which is really vague, like not vague, but simple, like southeast or west. Just go and you'll hit, you know, such and such road as a bailout spot. If I'm in the wilderness, I would more, I don't know that I've ever been so out of touch with where I was that I wasn't able to navigate. Maybe an exception would be on a mountain orienteering that we were doing up above Bear Valley. So if you're familiar with McHugh Peak area, there are five ridges that come down off of McHugh Peak, and in a thick fog, they can actually be quite disorienting as to which way is which.
So.
And we did have a mountain orienteering up there a few years back in a very thick fog, and I felt fortunate that that's totally my backyard. I live on one of those ridges. And still, it was really tough to stay in complete contact with the map. And I know that that is what saved me compared to many of the other folks who were out there getting lost and going down the wrong ridge.
Concentrate.
Was that I looked constantly back and forth between my map and the immediate features on the landscape to make sure that they were always in conjunction with each other.
It seems to me the worst times I've been lost there are mostly like you end up on a route that's much harder than you thought. And then you've got to decide to go back, to double back. You're going to be very late, or to do something that's hard or scary. And it's because maybe you weren't concentrating as hard on where you should be as you could, or maybe you just get bad luck, like you're saying, and fog comes down. Roman, I'm sure you've been lost a few times.
Well, you know, I have a definition for lost, and being lost is not knowing where you are and not knowing how to get back. So I've not known where I was many times, and that's when you sort of lose contact with the map. Or you think you know where you are, and then you come to the realization, oh, wait, and then you're trying to bend the map to reality or bend reality to the map, and you just can't get
this
it.
This has got to be that. This has got to be that.
My compass is broken. My compass is
broken. Oh, my compass. Yeah, there must be a magnetic anomaly here because it's pointing to the lodestone over there.
That's
this
so
is
true.
Wrong.
Yeah. Consciously, we'll do that.
And, very consciously, I've said those words. The compass is wrong. And so when you're in the situation where you don't know where you are, but you know how to get back, then I kind of go back or cut the corner and you kind of figure out, well, here's...
Back to the last place where you did know where you
were. Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the only time, I think Jen and I were talking briefly about this. I knew that you would ask. You know, I thought you were going to say, Roman, well, have you ever been lost? And so, you know, I think the only time I've ever actually not known where I was or how to get back was like in Chengdu, China. You know, in the city, in a big city where nobody speaks English. And I thought I knew where I was and I didn't. And I had no idea how to get back. The cities with weird streets and things. And then, you know, then I had to ask somebody. But in the wilderness.
But I mean, you never climbed a mountain, start to come down, realize you've taken the wrong route down. And then you can't, it's hard to figure out like how to get down.
Yeah, yeah, I've done that. Yeah, yeah. I've been lost in the dark, you know, in Borneo in the jungle by myself. I got lost in the dark.
Any story I tell you can like 100 times beat it. It's really fun talking to you about this stuff.
Yeah, well, and then I usually stop. You know, and I kind of get myself together. I try to get control because when you're lost,
be rational.
Yeah, because when you're lost, you've sort of lost control. You know, there's all these different sort of levels of control that we have, and one of them is sort of knowing where you are and how to get back. And once you lose that, you're kind of really out of control. So I try to stop and build a little wider and wider world I do have control of, like get warm, make a fire. I love making fire, or if I have a stove, have some tea.
Get your consciousness calm and start to look at it from a good point of view.
Yeah,
and look
great
for a big feature.
We have got to go. This has really, really been a fun show. I want to thank both of my guests, Jen Jala from the Arctic Engineering Orienteering Club.
Thanks, Charles.
And Roman Dial from Alaska Pacific University. Thanks so much, Roman. And there's more information on the website at alaskapublic.org, as we said. On next week's show, we're talking about recreating with your dog, how to safely take your dog into the outdoors, and how to keep from bugging other people. And it's going to be a fun show, so please join us. And thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Monica Gokey. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.